Bob kicked us off by talking a little bit about the basis for third-party reimbursement and changes that are going on in the traditional fee-for-service model. Suzanne brought us home in terms of where our health educator skills are being used in clinical and hospital settings. Cheryl Lee talked about what's happening at the state level, and if you're working for a state or county, city, local health department, how the skills of health educators may fit in there and the transformations going on. But I thought all three of those presentations so far have hit home a variety of things just to sum it up here. Nomenclature. The nomenclature is very different than maybe what we've been hearing in the past, and that is going to demand that health educators also adjust to be at the table. The financing system, certainly tremendous changes going on, and we need to understand that. Different titles that are being used for the work that we've traditionally done, and we have to be able to think outside the box of that term health educator to help ourselves fit into those different roles that are being called upon. But they also underscored the fact that the training, the knowledge and skills and the competencies that we have fit right in. The titles may not be the same, but what the roles are really what they're asking us to do. What skills we need to bring to the table are what health educators are traditionally been trained in. I'm going to take a little bit of different tact here in the fourth quarter and talking about the role of the health education organization in our place at the table in health reform. And I'd like to know before I start, is there anybody that's working in another kind of chapter or state association that you might be responsible for a membership of, whether it's the health educators or anybody else? Some of this might ring true, but I think it also will also provide a level of discussion for us on where can an organization like SOFI be a better advocate for the role that you have in health reform. I have no relationships to disclose, by the way, either. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the contributions that health education professional groups have made to impact health education in the healthcare landscape so far, and areas for future influence and what we could be doing better as a professional organization. So just again to get us started on nomenclature, the health education profession has a variety of organizations, and the American Public Health Association in particular has two sections that represent health education. The one that's sponsoring this particular session, Public Health Education and Health Promotion section, and they also have a School Health Education and Services section. So as we talk about the broad landscape, we remember that they play a part in this. The Society for Public Health Education, which I represent, which is the only organization that has the independent arm representing the discipline of health education and health promotion. And then what Bob talked about earlier, there is a group that aligns the various organizations with working within health education and health promotion, and that's called the Coalition of National Health Education Organizations. There are eight of us. Those that were represented on the screen here, three of them are part of the coalition. This has been a group that has been functioning for some 40 years to bring together the disciplines in health education that work in different settings, such as school health, college health, at the health department director of state health departments. Eta Sigma Gamma is also a member, which represents the student honorary for health education, health educators. So we all meet once a month collectively to try to address overarching issues in our discipline. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about my organizing framework or prism for the work as the SOFI representative is to think about what can we do to move forward health education's role in health reform through these five different lenses, if you will: standards, continuing education, data, resources, and advocacy. So first of all, standards. Well, why do we care about standards? Standards are important for our field because they provide a framework for legitimacy for our place at the table. They are the basis, for example, of our recognition as a distinct occupational classification by the Department of Labor. If we didn't have standards for the professional preparation programs of our 250 professional preparation programs around the country, then we would have had a much more difficult time convincing the Department of Labor that, yes, we were a standalone profession, that we were distinct from the health education that's provided by nurses and many other professions that also provide health education, that we have a body of theory, and yes, we have a quality assurance system for ensuring that our professionals are trained in what they need to know on the front lines. APHA's public health ed section, some of you may or may not know, they were the first group out there to promote standards in the profession and the professional preparation of MPHs in health education. In the 1970s, they worked and have a document that's published as part of our history that enumerated all the different things that MPH, those trained as an MPH, should be able to do, and that eventually became the basis for accrediting programs in public health, that the Council on Education for Public Health, when they go in to accredit a professional prep program, they're looking at those particular, actually had roots back then, looking at those particular standards. And then as an organization, SOFI and the American Association for Health Education, we are accrediting or approving undergraduate programs in community health education, and there's also a similar corollary for the school health education program. So standards are important for our field, not only that you get quality, excellent education and training, but also externally to others that look at our discipline. And so our organization, SOFI, is continually involved in re-examining those standards and advocating for those standards. We talked about the standards at the professional prep level, but we also have standards at the individual level, or the certification of those that work as health education specialists. The health education competencies were initiated in the 1970s, and that eventually led to the role delineation study. And we were the first population-based profession to be recognized with competency. So I think it's really important, something you can pat yourself on the back when you look at all the other public health disciplines coming on now that say competencies are important. Well, we were there first, and we continue to refine those. And SOFI and APHA play a very important role in looking at those competencies every 5 years to ensure that they are keeping up with what you have to do on the front line, the important knowledge and skill that, whether it's as it relates to a patient-centered medical home or you work at a public health department, that we're actually developing those competencies based on what you know and what you say is important in the field. So we continue to work and refine those, and that has eventually led to our certification system in health education, both at the entry level, the CHES and the Master CHES, which just became came on our horizon in the last year. What are we doing in the area of continuing education? Well, we have to keep up with, it's our job to be on the front lines of providing you continuing ed in the areas as healthcare reform is being implemented, is being changed. And just as one example, APHA's 2011 mid-year meeting specifically looked at how to implement health reform. And there are a variety of papers and things available on the website if you have not yet had a chance to really dig through some of that. I think it would be informative to you if you haven't had a chance to participate. Each year, the profession of health education organizations gets together and defines a core advocacy agenda for the field. We will be in our 16th year of offering the annual Health Education Advocacy Summit. So providing continuing education on how to be an effective advocate on the front line is an important role that we play. And actually, about 225 or 250 folks come to Washington every year. I invite you to put March 2nd to 4th on your calendars to come to Washington. We'll train you in the basic skills of advocacy, and then you get to go to Capitol Hill and actually meet with your members of Congress. And Jeff Goodman's here as one of our graduates, and it's really great to see he's come back now and has become one of the SOFI student interns, graduate student interns, that is helping us shape the 16th Annual Health Education Advocacy Summit. SOFI's also been engaged in offering a State Health Policy Institute, and we know that all good ideas don't necessarily come from the top down. They come from the bottom up. And we have been training folks on the front line to be effective educators of, especially around chronic disease, of their state policymakers. So bringing the latest evidence to the front line, being able to talk about return on investment and other things to those who are making the policies at the state and local level, and the fact that that's not always the same as the way we communicate with congressional leaders that have get different sources of information and operate in different contexts in terms of their legislative calendar. We have a variety of webinars that are available to you throughout the year. These are free. And now, if you have missed some of these that I pointed out, the National Prevention Strategy or Protecting Women's Health and the Affordable Care Act, these are all available to you online to help you, again, keep moving forward with not only the nomenclature, but how you can become aware of the latest developments and apply those in your job. In terms of data, I think this is an important role for professional organizations and probably one we haven't done as well as we should. I think Cezanne pointed out, we often don't have the return on investment data that we could make a more effective case to those with whom we work, the different stakeholders. And while we have done some work in this regard, one example would be a study we did in about 2006 of employers' attitudes toward health educators. And if you haven't seen the results of that, it is online in the SOPI website. What we found from that was very informative. Just to cut to the chase, a lot of the employers understood or knew health education existed as a discipline, weren't in totally aware of the various competencies and the unique skills, especially with regard to evaluation and data. So I think it's something that, again, if you're on the front lines trying to push through and educate others to what skills you have, those are things that you need to stress to them. They also informed our thinking about how we can communicate to employers and using that title health education specialist. Notice I didn't say certified health education specialist, but health education specialist. That health education specialist nomenclature stuck out in the work that we did as getting the attention of employers. So I just commend that to you in thinking about how you communicate about your own role. But we could do a better job as a professional organization in looking at the numbers of health educators out there, their demographics, your influences of health reform on your particular roles, your influences of health reform on your particular role, the impact of state and local policies. I think SOFI, as well as APHA, could do a better job of being a convener to invitational panels to help add to the evidence base and find out what is best practice. And then identifying areas for innovation. What do we need to do to move the needle forward for the role of health education at the table? In terms of resources, there are a variety of other resources that groups like APHA and SOFI make available. There is a plethora of excellent policy papers on APHA's website that I really commend for you to take advantage of and looking at not only nomenclature and issues of financing, being able to explain, but also being able to share those with your colleagues. In terms of some of the resources that SOFI has, I mentioned Cezanne is associate editor for one of our journals, Health Promotion Practice. We've had a variety of different columns in the journal around health reform and its impact on health educators. This is just one example, the patient-centered medical home and why it matters to health educators. We're in the process of developing a white paper on health educators' role in health reform, and a lot of the work that we've done to lead up to this panel today I think will be very informative. We have on our website a series of fact sheets that we've worked on the last year of getting the stories of people like you in the field of what is going to happen with our budget cuts, what's already happening to places like Minnesota and Vermont and other states and communities on reducing the budgets for public health and health education. And so you can use those fact sheets in your advocacy. We have a brand new Educating State Policymakers Guide about prevention and the role of health education in prevention. And then we have an all-new website with a variety of other resources for you there to help you make the case for prevention. finally, and last but not least, our role in the advocacy arena. One of the reasons Sophie moved from Berkeley, California in 1995 to Washington, D.C. was to be a player on the front lines, to advocate for our discipline. So we are involved. We have a policy director, Jerrica Mathis, on our staff, who formerly worked for the Congressional Black Caucus. We're continually watching the regulations, commenting on proposed regulations and legislation. We issue advocacy alerts to our members, just like as well as APHA does, and often receive, to help us get involved in commenting on legislation or regulations. We submit testimony throughout the year, and we participate in coalitions because, as we know, our voices can be stronger when we're aligned with others in our public health profession. So we work very closely in terms of achieving our policy objectives with many other coalitions. And then legislative visits to Capitol Hill. That's an important part of continuing to remind our policymakers of what our priorities are for in terms of health education and disease prevention, health promotion. Well, I won't go into too much about the advocacy for the profession in terms of working with groups like the American Diabetes Association or the National Certification Board for Diabetes Educators. It's a work in progress, but this is the kind of thing that a professional organization representing many members of the field can push forward and be the nudge to change. I just came away this morning from being at the table for a brand new a task force that the Association of Schools of Public Health have undertaken to look at revising the next 100 years of public health. What should be the basic training of the MPH, and whether we should start working from community college level forward. What should that training and education look like? And of course, important for them to recognize the discipline of health education and health promotion and what we bring to that. The National Public Health Information Coalition is a group of the health communicators on the front line. We're out there in the front talking about helping them with their certification process and making sure it dovetails well with health educators. And finally, reaching out to major stakeholders, especially with regard to areas like how community health workers are now being used and how that distinction should play out with health educators. So in summary, I would just say we have a vital role. Health education organizations also have a vital role to ensure that you have opportunities for jobs in the new health reform landscape. We'll have to be listening to you to reflect on how what you're doing in the field should be reflected back in our competencies, what new skills you need, what continuing education we need to provide, and then how can we better serve you into the future. We're always open and encouraged to listen to your thoughts and recommendations for what you need. So with that, I'd like to open it up to questions and comments for all of our speakers, and I hope you'll join me in thanking them for all of their presentations today. We'd like to hear from you. Where are you working? What are the issues and the things that you're grappling with health reform? Right here.
That they're uncomfortable with, health education specialists can have that. But also patients find finally have a relationship that they didn't have before that they've been craving. And the idea of the patient family and Bob was so resonating with what we're trying to do. So if someone could speak to the faith side of that.
Well, I think your question and understanding is so important. Just two things, and then I think my colleague, Sherry Lee, would like to say something as well. What we know from the satisfaction literature is that patient and family satisfaction is strongly correlated with physician and clinician satisfaction. So as the water level rises for any of those individuals in the team, we're really seeing it has a positive or negative effect. So you're, in fact, right on the mark in realizing that satisfaction is one of the important metrics in addition to clinical outcomes and workflow analyses and cost effectiveness. But I also think, and there's a wonderful piece that just came out by Maureen, and I always destroy her name, Bosignano, who is the director, took Don Berwick's position at the Institute of Healthcare Improvement. And it says, beyond the patient satisfaction, and it's really looking at the experience of care and really looking at that meaningful contribution and talk about ahas that the health system has had with having patients and families at the table with clinicians and administrators and other data management individuals to really look at the full picture. We've had a missing piece, and I often kindred to a missing place at the table. The seats that have been empty, and they, in some ways, in our world, we're used to, if you will, thinking about the endpoints and the end users, and yet in healthcare, this has been a huge absence. So you're right, it's an important metric piece. I was, though, equally persuaded by her piece that just came out, and it's on their website, just like a week and a half ago, that sort of looks at that piece and saying, let's not stop there, though. So thank you, and Shirley, please.
In regards to Minnesota's healthcare homes, we've had patients and consumer voice as part of the whole setup. But in our standards, we have a performance measurement standard. And one of the requirements is that in the practices redesign, they need to have patients as part of that, and we look for evidence. So when we go out on, we actually also go out on site visits, and that's different from the NCQA process of just submitting paperwork. So we'll interview clinicians, we'll interview staff, and we'll interview patients. And we've trained patients to do the peer-to-peer interviewing as well, so we've got the patient voice as part of it. One of the other things, in my introduction with consumer messaging, we have a consumer and family council that provides input into standards, input into whatever we're working with. And then lastly, with the our performance measurement, we look at patient health, so we look at optimal diabetes rates, we look at optimal vascular care, optimal asthma care, but we also look at patient experience. And we are looking to use the CAHPS survey, but the patient-centered medical home CAHPS survey. And then lastly, we look at cost. So we look at those three things. And that's all being we're working with the benchmarking as well. So, I didn't go into detail on that, but that is one of the major things that we do.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to add one more thing to what was said, and it's only that patient satisfaction has two components to it. One is hospitals are actually going to get reimbursed for satisfaction, where a portion of their reimbursement will be based on how satisfied the customers are, so they can retain a portion of their reimbursement. But I think the satisfaction that Bill might have been talking about as well is just the fact that the teams that are working with health educators are enjoying their job more because the experience from the patients is better and the experiences of the physicians are better. So there's reimbursement patient satisfaction, but there's also team building satisfaction. I don't think we can undersell either one.
Very good point. Other questions? Mm-hmm.
I glossed over an important piece about this work, and that is our role as advocates for transforming care. And I think one of the things that I came away with from both these interviews, but just in general working with health, all kinds of healthcare organizations, veteran administration facilities, our military treatment, as well as hospitals, is that the more that we have individuals with our value set and our core principles of practice within the organization also transforming it, it makes a lot less resistance for those of us who feel we're more outside the system, whether it be public health practice or whether it even be a clinical practice setting or health system, to really partner with those players. And I think that you're exactly right. Ariella Ward, one of the people I interviewed, was with Employee Wellness, and it was really why I tried to highlight a little bit of her work, because it is, it's a complex puzzle. And it requires all those pieces, but I also was so taken, even the woman who worked for an unknown medical device company said they're doing community-based planning and they're looking at those population assessment measures as well, not just the payer groups, not just the health system. And I believe it's all of us at the table that's really going to help us transform healthcare to sort of the standards that we're hoping to aspire to achieve, Accountable Care Act and beyond.
And in Minnesota, we have the health plans are at the table. All of our work groups in designing the standards, designing the patient, the payment methodology, and I think just about every one of our groups have had the health plans involved. And so they know where we're going. Some of the tension has been is that these kinds of things are being brought into the primary care setting. And with the health plans, with their health coaching that's telephonic, and they're just looking at their members, I hear, are we going to lose, from people, are we going to lose our jobs because it's going to come there? But we're all working together to see what's going to be the best fit for our, at least for our area. So we do work with them very closely, and it's a good point. We want to use them as an ally.
I think we're running out of time at our next session. Presenters are anxious to get here. I want to thank you all for participating today. I hope this has given you some insights and ideas as to how you can become more effective advocates for your own positions, whether they be at healthcare departments, university settings, health departments, university settings, clinics, or hospital settings. And how you might be able to share some of for what you learned today with others in the discipline. So thanks very much for participating, and thanks again to our panelists.